That's it here, right?
Well, my ages are not going to be going back to school anytime soon. They are in the dispensable age. At least that's
Right.
what the government thinks.
Grade 5 or whatever. Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. All right. What? Please God, I don't know. Maybe 1 year. You know, machala for a year, whatever. Hopefully by Purim, but I don't see that happening.
Don't bet on it.
I'm not betting on it. We were betting that next Rosh Hashanah will be like this Rosh Hashanah. It wouldn't surprise me.
That's very pessimistic.
Yeah, I hope not. I hope I'm wrong, but I'd say 50-50 chance. Why? Okay, whatever. I can't worry about it. We can only do
don't
what we
expect
can do.
To spend Pesach with your family. I think that's
yeah, Pesach. Yeah, I got you. No, it's whatever. Okay, time to start. Enough of the depressing stuff about Corona. Let's learn some Torah. Pekudei Hashem Yisharim Misamchei Lev. Learning Torah makes us happy and joyful and exciting. So
okay, mute us all.
It's all yours. Part two, to learn Torah and to see Torah, Eretz Yisrael. Vakasha.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Shuli Mishkin. Welcome back to people who were here last week. Welcome to people who are here for the first time. We are going to be continuing our story of Tanakh and archaeology. I'm going to start sharing my screen. And if last week we talked about King David, today we are going to talk about one of his major adversaries, and those are the Philistines, the Plishtim. Okay, we'll talk about this picture in a minute, but just if you know a little of your Bible, of your Tanakh, you know that the major enemy from the book of Judges, from Sefer Shoftim, pretty much through the time of King David, up until almost until the time of his son, the major enemies are the Philistines. Okay, we have Shimshon, who has to fight against the Philistines. King Saul is vanquished by them. King David has to be challenged by them. And it's really only around the time of King Solomon that we don't have an immediate threat from the Plishtim. However, they haven't gone anywhere, right? They are going to be around in the land of Israel, maybe push back, maybe less of a threat, but they remain a force in the land of Israel until the only one who really vanquishes them is the same one who vanquishes us, and that is Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia. When he comes and he destroys Jerusalem, he also goes and destroys Gaza and Ashkelon, and he also exiles the Philistines just like he exiles us. And we're going to see as we go along that Am Israel, the children of Israel, and the Philistines have kind of similar destinies, at least in the beginning. Right? They take a turn towards the end, and that will be the suspense that we'll have to be waiting for until the end of the lecture to find out. But they start out in very similar places, and they follow similar trajectories. Now, we hear about them a lot in Tanakh, but we don't know very much about them. Okay, basically, our impression of the Plishtim, of the Philistines in Tanakh, is what has given rise to the meaning, the colloquial meaning of the word Philistine, right? Oh, you're such a Philistine. You don't read anything. You don't go to the opera. What a Philistine you are, right? Somebody who's uncultured, somebody who doesn't care about the finer things in life. And that's the impression we get about them from Tanakh. But as we're going to see, archaeology in the last 80 years or so has given us a new perspective, has taught us many things about these kind of very elusive characters. And we're going to see that in a cultural sense, they're not Philistines at all. Their material culture is very rich. In fact, it's much richer than the Israelite material culture. What are they lacking? That we're going to have to see as we go along. But really, archaeological excavations in the past few decades have filled in for us so much that Tanakh doesn't tell us. And Tanakh doesn't tell us these things on purpose, right? Tanakh is not a book of history. It's not intended to teach us who are the Philistines, what is their culture, what is their religion. That's not particularly important to Tanakh, only when it comes up, by the way. But it's interesting for us to know. So we are going to start, and we're going to really be flipping back and forth between the verses and what's been found in the real world, okay, in archaeology, in the excavations that have been done here. So first of all, where did the Philistines come from? So that actually, we have quite a few sources in Tanakh, right? In Amos, in Ezekiel, in Zephaniah, each one of them talks about the Philistines who seem to have come from somewhere to the west of the land of Israel, right? Take a look at the Pasuk in Amos, the very first verse here. To me, O Israelites, you are just like the Ethiopians, declared the Lord. True, I brought Israel up from the land of Egypt, right? You think you're so special, I took you out of Egypt. But God says, I also brought the Philistines from Kaphtor and the Arameans from Kir. So you're not the only nation that was brought from one place to another. And we're going to see that the Philistines, like us, are immigrants to the land of Canaan. They're invaders to the land of Canaan. Where's Kaphtor? Kaphtor is probably the island of Crete. Okay, and what we're going to see as we go along, we'll get to a map in another minute, is that they are coming from places west of the land of Israel. I'm deliberately being kind of vague because we're going to see there's not one origin. Okay, but they are Mycenaean, they are Greek, they are perhaps Sardinian, right? Think of the Mediterranean, go towards the west, that's where they're coming from. Okay, we have other psukim, right? Ezekiel assuredly says, God, I will stretch out my hand against the Philistine and cut off the kretim, the kreti et a kretim, et kretim. Sounds a lot better in Hebrew, right? We have this allusion, kreti kretim. But again, kretim, maybe Crete, maybe Cyprus, one of these islands, okay? And again, in Sephania, I'll just read it in Hebrew. I didn't put it in the PowerPoint, right? Ho yoshvei chevel hayam goy kretim, you, a nation of kretim who inhabit the seacoast, okay? So again, your origin from the west, from the Greek islands, and now you are on the seacoast. And this has really been proven by archaeology. We're going to see as we go along, that the origin of the Philistines, or as they're called in more modern research, the Sea Peoples, because we're going to see there's not just one, is from the area to the west of the land of Israel. And we're going to see that their culture comes from these places as well, but their culture changes the longer that they are here in the land of Israel. They are not all from one place. They do not all have one origin. Some of them indeed are mercenaries. Professor Aaron Mayer, who we're going to talk about, who's been excavating in Gat for quite a long time, for almost two decades. He calls them pirates, right? There are these seafaring people who go and are looking for places to stay. Why are they going? Let's take a look and see where they're coming from. Don't be upset if I am ignoring your questions in the chat. I am going to ignore them until the end, and then I promise I will look at all of them. I don't promise I will know the answers, but I do promise I will look at them. Okay, so where are they coming from? So in case you had trouble envisioning the map in your head, here you're getting a little more of a sense of it, right? From the islands that are closer to the land of Israel, Cyprus, Crete, from further away, from Mycenae, from Troy, and as we're going to see, from even further away, from Sardinia, from Italy. Okay, and that's going to come up at the very end. Why are they suddenly picking themselves up? And they suddenly pick themselves up at the same time that the Israelites pick themselves up from Egypt, and they come into the land, and we'll see that in a minute. But we're talking about 13th, 12th century before the Common Era. Okay, what's going on? You have a very interesting combination of forces that leads to a lot of migration. And we've seen this. We've seen this in the recent past, right? Think of the late 19th, early 20th century, the huge migrations from Europe to the West, to America. Right? People who leave because of economic reasons, because of religious reasons, social reasons. There are periods in history where migrations happen, and this is one of those periods. Why is it happening? Most historians think it's a combination of two things. Number one, the great empires are experiencing a shakiness, right? A vacuum of power, the most important one being Egypt, right? Egypt, which is always the gorilla in the room of the ancient Near East, is not as powerful in the 13th and the 12th century, right? Some people connect that with us and with our leaving. So there's an opening, there's a vacuum that new nations can step into. So that's one thing, kind of like the political statesman-like thing that's going on. But you also have a chain of natural disasters that are happening around this time, the most famous one being the eruption of the volcano on the island of Santorini, which caused places their people had been living for centuries to not be so inhabitable anymore. And they start to move, they go on the move looking for new places to live. Let's go back. Well, actually, let's go forward 1 minute and then we'll go back. Okay. The picture that I showed you in the beginning, okay, this is a drawing, an enlargement of a drawing from a mortuary temple in Egypt. Okay, this is the great Paro Ramses III, and this is his mortuary temple in a place called Medinat Habu. And he writes about rebuffing these peoples, right? And take a look at what he says. The foreign countries made a conspiracy in their islands. No land could stand before their arms. They were coming forward towards Egypt. Their confederation, right? And here we already see, we're not talking about one peoples. Their confederation was the Pleshet, right? Pleshet, like Plishtim, Cheker, Shekeles, Denye, Weshesh. We don't know who all of these different nations are. Lands united. Those who reach my frontier, their seed is not, their heart and soul are finished forever. So Ramses puts this on his temple because he won, right? These guys are coming to invade the coast of Egypt, and he manages to chase them away. And if we look, let's actually go back for a moment to this picture, right? This is just a detail. The whole picture is even more amazing. It shows them coming in boats with wagons, right? With the Gansa Mishpacha, with the whole family. They're coming, they're looking for a place to live. They're not just warriors who are coming. And here in this picture, this is already where they have been taken captive, right? You can see that they are even kind of chained here, right? And being brought, taken prisoner. But in the larger picture, we also have a vision of their, we see that their boats look like. And here we can see their headdresses, and they look very different than the Egyptians. Right? The artist clearly made them distinct from the Egyptians. One of the things we notice most strongly about them, first of all, they're clean shaven. That's already something unusual. Okay. But what you notice is their headdresses, right? Take a look at their headdresses. Okay? They're almost kind of like bird-like. We're going to see birds are a big theme in Philistine pottery. So here you have these almost bird-like headdresses. And in fact, their boats have birds on the prow, on the front. I don't know. I'm not a boat person, so I don't know if that was the right term, but you know what I mean, right? The front of the boat has a big bird's head. So they look very distinctive. And interestingly enough, in the mural, you have two types of invaders. You have these guys with the bird headdresses, and you also have other ones who have horns, helmets with horns, right? Almost imagine almost like Viking helmets, right? So there clearly is more than one group here. Ramses kicks them out, and what do? They go up the coast towards the land of Israel. And at that same time, more or less, we have an invasion from the other side. So what's going on here, right? 12th century, the Canaanites don't know what hit them. Along come the Philistines coming up from the coast of Egypt and taking over the coast of the land of Canaan. We're going to see they're not only on the coast, but this is where they start out. Meanwhile, about the same time, here come our Israelites, right? Coming around from the other side. And they are entering the land from the east. Okay, so we have an invasion from the west, we have an invasion from the east, and we have the Canaanites, the indigenous inhabitants of the land, who are squeezed between them. And that's going to be part of our story as we go along. The Canaanites keep being squeezed, and they keep having to be conquered by the Philistines, conquered by the Israelites. Eventually, some of them will choose to join one or the other. Many scholars think that many of them choose to join the Israelites, and they differentiate themselves from the Philistines. We'll come back to that a little bit later, okay? But what we have set up here is a potential for clashes, first of all, between the Canaanites and these other invaders, and between the invaders themselves, right? The Israelites coming from the east, they want to keep moving towards the west. The Philistines coming from the west, they want to keep moving towards the east. And we have this shared destiny, certainly in the first couple of centuries of our coexistence in the land, okay? Shared destiny, I don't know if it's the right word, right? It's a shared conflict. And that's where we get to our story of David and Goliath, because they are going to intersect, right? They are going to conflict exactly at this meeting point in the middle. So let's just move on, right, to understand one more map. before we get to a little bit of the artifacts of what we have found, right? First of all, where are the Philistines? Where do they go? Okay, we're going to see they have this Pentapolis, these five cities that are down by the coast and a little bit inland, but that's not the only place where they are, okay? First of all, Tanakh tells us they're in other places, right? Think of the story of King Saul, right? King Saul goes to battle against the Philistines in a bunch of places, okay? At one point, they're all the way inland here next to Beit El in Michmas, okay? They made their way into the heartland of Israelite territory. And at the end of Saul's life, where have they made their way? All the way up across the Jezreel Valley. Here they are in Mount Gilboa. They are really cutting the land of Israel in two. Okay, so the clashes take place not only, let's just erase all my squiggles for a minute, right? Not only in this area, what we would call the Elah Valley, right? The Shpelah, the lowlands between the two. And that's the story of David and Goliath, right? Remember, David's coming from Beit Lechem. Goliath is coming from Gat. And they meet in the middle in the Valley of Elah, but that's not the only place where we have conflict. We also hear about it as the Philistines become more powerful, right? We hear about the conflict in other parts of the country as well. And like I said, eventually David beats them back, Solomon even more so, and they stay in their areas. But at their height of their power, right, at the time of King Saul, they really are reaching out all over the land of Israel, trying to control the whole land of Israel. Okay, one last thing, just while we have this nice map in front of us before we go to some of the other pictures here. We know about Philistine settlements in other places. Not talking about conquest, I'm talking about settlement, okay? We know that the Philistines are up here by Dor. They are in Jaffa. They may even be in Akko. We're not 100% sure, okay? We have a whole area near Haifa we're gonna talk about. Are these all the same people? Not necessarily, right? They are all part of this larger group of people who have come to conquer, but they're not necessarily all connected to each other. One other thing, which I'm guessing a few of the chat questions are, I haven't looked, are these plishtim, the plishtim of Sefer Bereishit, right, of the book of Genesis? Abraham meets the plishtim, right? Yitzchak meets the plishtim. According to Aaron Mayer and other scholars, they are not, right? Which we could explain in two different ways. First of all, maybe there's an earlier wave of invasion, right? They're not in the same cities. They don't have the same culture. It's not the same stuff. Maybe there's an earlier wave of invasion and they get the same name. The other possibility is that they're in a similar area and we call them, right? We call things by what they're known later on, right? They are not Plishtim, but they're living in the Plishti areas. It's an interesting question, but basically, we do not have any connection between the early Philistines of the Torah, and the Philistines of Navi. Okay. One other very important, and I know this is a very sophisticated audience, so you guys don't believe this, but it's important to know, the Philistines are not the Palestinians, or rather the Palestinians are not the Philistines, right? The Palestinians have called themselves everything, right? They're the ancient Christians, they're the ancient Canaanites, they're the ancient Philistines, they're Arabs, right? They're Arabs, they've been in the land for a long time, but they do not have an ethnic or religious or national connection to the Philistines. Palestine is called Palestine years later by the Romans, right? After the Bar Kokhba revolt, the Romans want to remove any trace of Jewish identity with this land. So they name it after this ancient enemy of the Jews that no longer exists in the world, and they call it Palestine. But that Palestine and Philistines and the Palestinians, not connected to each other. Okay, so just to get that out of the way while we are here. Okay, let's move on. So we said, they are coming. Different groups are coming from different places, but all from more or less, right, the more western part of the Mediterranean, Greece and the islands, and they are bringing their culture with them. And one of the really fascinating things that archaeology is showing us, and we'll see this as we go along, is that the first layers of Philistine settlement are very Mycenaean, Sardinian, whatever they are not Canaanite. Okay, they have their pottery looks different, and their temples look different, and their burial looks different, and their houses look different. As time passes, they become more and more like the locals, right? We're going to come back to that. But these are some of the earlier layers. So take a look at the picture here on the top. This is from Tel Mikneh, which we now know is Ekron. We'll tell that story in a minute. Okay. And this is a hearth, a megaron. The temples, the early temples, okay, are in the style of Greek temples, where the centerpiece of the temple is a large hearth, right? As time passes, their temples start to look much more like Canaanite / Israelite temples, right? With an ulam and a heichal, with these two rooms that you go from one to the other, from an outer court to an inner court. But the earlier ones look more Greek, okay? Their pottery, take a look at the picture on the bottom, right? This is the classic Philistine pottery, these beautiful birds. Kibbutz Rivadim, where Tel Mikneh is, had at a certain point a jewelry business, and this was like their insignia because they're built on the site of a Philistine site. Okay, so they had this beautiful bird pottery. As time passes, it becomes more Canaanite. Also, from what we know about them from Tanakh, they take with them Greek ideas. What do I mean by that? They have these city-states, right? We're going to see they have these five city-states. Each one is run by a seren. A seren is not a name that we hear about in Israelite government, but it's kind of an officer, a king, sort of, okay? And that's coming from the Greek culture, okay? And even the story of David and Goliath, right? It's a very strange story if you think about it, right? Goliath comes out to the field and he says, listen, why should you all be killed? Why don't you pick a champion? And we'll pick a champion, i.e. me, and the champions will fight, and whichever one wins, he's the winner. And that's a strange idea, but it does echo what we know about from Greek culture, right? Single combat fighting, where you have a champion who fights for everybody. So we have a lot of these Mycenaean, Greek, etc. elements, okay, in the architecture, in all sorts of different things. And that's going to change as time goes by. Wow, there are a lot of chats here. I'm curious to see what all these comments are. All right, we'll find out. Rabbi Kalman, you can read them and tell me if they're sensational. Okay. All right. Let's understand our Pentapolis for a minute. Pentapolis is just a fancy word for five cities, right? The Tanakh mentions these cities quite a few times, okay? And they are the major five cities of the Philistines, right? The three on the coast, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and the two a little further inland, Ekron and Gat. Again, these are not the only Philistine sites. They move up. Here we have Aphek. They're going to be in Gezer. They're in Jaffa. They're up even perhaps near Beit She'an. But these are the main cities, the cities where they start. By the way, even here, they are not only these cities, right? As it says in Sefer Yoshua, right? In the book of Joshua, talks about a city, Ubnoteha, and its daughters, right? I was just learning this with my son last night. Its daughters doesn't mean children. It means the villages around, right? You have this kind of maybe you want to picture like a feudal lord, right? Who has he's in charge, and he protects all the villages around. So Ashkelon or Gat might be the main city, but everything around it is under the auspices of that city as well. Now, of these five, three of them were never lost. Their identity was always known, and that's the three on the coast. Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, we always knew where they were. We didn't forget them, but the other two, Ekron and Gat, were a little mysterious, and we're going to see how they were discovered. Ekron, definitely, and Gat, I would say 98.5% that we know where Gat is. Okay, one last thing. This is clear from Tanakh and also from archaeology. They're Pentapolis, right? They're these five, this league of five cities, but there's a first among equals. At different times in Philistine history, one city is more significant than the others. Gat holds that position for a long time until it's destroyed by the Arameans, in the 7th century, right? Then Aza takes its place. So they are all powerful, but there's always one that's kind of the leader among all the others. So that's also an interesting thing that we see, both from Tanakh as well as from archaeology, where we see that certain cities just stop existing at a certain point. All right, let me get rid of my pictures. Okay, and let us go on. Okay, Gat and Ekron, where are they? Okay, so there were many suggestions. And again, we know, how do we identify Tanakh sites, right? Already in the 14th century, a brilliant explorer of the land of Israel named Eshtori HaParchi, he writes a book called Kaftor VaPerach, and he's the first one who articulates the idea that we all know very well, which is that if a name, an Arabic name of a town, sounds more or less like the name that we know from Tanakh or the Mishnah or whatever, and it's more or less in the same place, chances are it's just a continuation of the name. The Arabs came, they didn't bother to give new names. Why should they give new names? They just kept the name. They pronounced it a little bit differently. So if a little bit north of Jerusalem, you have a town that's called Bitin, Beit El, makes sense, right? You have Safuria up in the Galil, Tzipori, right? So Eshtori HaParchi already knew that and understood that. But Ekron and Gat were still rather mysterious, and we did not know where it was. And in the early days, right, if you know your Israeli geography a little bit, you know that not far from Rehovot, I actually did not put it on this map, but not far from Rehovot, right about here, is a place called Kiryat Ekron, right? Because they thought Ekron was there. Hey, they also thought it was by Gedera. They weren't in the wrong place, they just weren't exactly in the right place, right? All different kinds of suggestions. Gat, if you ever wondered why the big town of Kiryat Gat is called Kiryat Gat, because the assumption was that Gat is right here. Now we're going to see that Gat is not that far away, but it's not exactly there, right? It's kind of closer to here. I take that back. It's on 383. It's over here. Okay. And Ekron also, not too far from Gedera, but not in exactly the right place. Okay. How were these places found? What was found and when? That's the mysteries that we are going to try and solve now. So Ekron has an amazing story. Okay. And to understand the story of Ekron, you have to go to 1948. Okay. 1948, the four communities of Gush Etzion, Kfar Etzion, Ein Surim, Masuot Yitzchak, and Rivadim are destroyed by the Jordanian invasion, May 1948. Three of them, right, Kfar Etzion is more problematic, there's a terrible massacre there, but the other three quickly reestablish themselves inland to the west, not so far from Ashdod, okay? And Kibbutz Rivadim is one of those places, right? Kibbutz Rivadim reestablishes itself. Now, on the outskirts of Kibbutz Rivadim, the new Kibbutz Rivadim, is an archaeological site, which was called Tel Mikne. And one of the members of the kibbutz, his name was Natan Idlin, and like many Israelis of that generation and today, he was an amateur archaeologist. Archaeology is a passion in Israel, right? Every other month you have an article in the newspaper about how some kid on a school trip or with his parents finds an ancient idol somewhere, and everybody's very excited, right? So he was fascinated by this site, and he went and he explored, and he saw that very clearly it is a large and wealthy site. Okay? Among the things he found were many, many olive presses. Okay? The economy here was based on olives and olive oil, and he came to the conclusion that it was a Philistine site because he had this pottery that was well known already, even in the 50s, to be Philistine pottery. But the question is, which city was it? And he was a secular man. Rivadim of the four kibbutzim was the secular one, but he knew his Tanakh. And he understood, he remembered the story from the book of Samuel, which I will remind you of, which you probably remember as well, right? We have this dramatic story where the children of Israel are going into battle against the Philistines. This is in the time period where Eli is the high priest in Shiloh, right? And the people of Israel come to him and they say, we want to take the Ark of the Covenant with us as a good luck charm, whatever you want to call it, we want to take it with us. Eli is not thrilled, but they take it with them. At first, the Philistines are very frightened. They say, oh, look at this. The God who took them out of Egypt, he's here to fight. And then you have this very interesting flip in the story. And the Philistines are basically like, okay, man up. You know, you think that you can't beat this God? Of course you can beat this God. And they do. They take the arrow and they take the ark. They capture it. They bring it to their cities very triumphantly. But then things don't work out quite so well, right? Everywhere they bring it, there are terrible plagues. We're going to talk about one of those plagues a little bit later. Mice and other interesting plagues. And each city kind of says, you know what? We've had it enough. Why don't you guys take a turn? And finally, they have enough, right? The people of Ekron are the last ones who have it. And they say, we want to get rid of this. But we want to know, was this something that came from God, the God of the Israelites, or was it a coincidence? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to build a wagon. We're going to put the ark on the wagon. We're going to take some cows, cows who have calves at home, so they'll be reluctant to leave. And then we're just going to let them go. And if they go to the nearest Israelite settlement, then it must be that this must from the hand of God. And if not, then not, right? And that's what we have in the psukim here in the verses. The cows went straight ahead along the road to Beit Shemesh. Lo and behold, they went in one straight line from Ekron to the closest Israelite city, which is Beit Shemesh. They went along a single high road, lowing as they went, turning off neither to the right nor to the left. And the lords of the Philistines walked behind them as far as the border of Beit Shemesh. And the people of Beit Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. They looked up and saw the ark, and they rejoiced when they saw it. Now, we'll get to the map in a second, which is where Natan Idlin had his aha moment, right? But take a look at the picture for a second. This is a great picture from synagogue in Dura Europus in Syria, where we have these amazing drawings on the wall that tell the stories of Tanakh and the Midrashim. And here are our five Philistine lords, right? The five of them of the five cities. Here are our cows, and here's the ark. And they are leaving behind the Philistine temple, the destruction, and they're heading straight to Beit Shemesh. Okay, now what happened to Natan Idlin? What was his brilliant hypothesis? Okay, we'll look at the map on the top in a second, but take a look at the map on the bottom. Here's Kibbutz Rivadim. Okay, here is the modern city of Beit Shemesh, but the modern city of Beit Shemesh is right on the outskirts of Tel Beit Shemesh, of ancient Beit Shemesh. And if you do a pretty straight line due east, you get to Beit Shemesh. Okay, the cows make a straight beeline to the first Israelite city. Therefore, Rivadim, the Philistine site, must be Ekron, because Ekron is where they left from. Ekron is where they went. And that was his hypothesis. Now, just take a look at the map on the top for a second, and then we'll see if he was right or wrong. Okay, but the map on the top has it set out very nicely, right? The ark is captured at Afek. Okay, then it's taken to Ashdod, to Gat, to Ekron. And in Ekron, they say, enough already. They send it to Beit Shemesh, right? It stays in Beit Shemesh for only a little while because it's dangerous, right? Anybody who touches it is struck down. It's sent to Kiryat Yearim, and eventually King David brings it to Jerusalem, right? So that's the trajectory that it follows. But this suggestion of Natan Idlin was a very interesting idea. But it took more than 40 years for it to be proven. And in the 1990s at Tel Mikna, where they had been doing all kinds of excavations, they found the Welcome to Ekron sign. Okay, they found an inscription, right, written actually in the Semitic script, in the script that's the ancient Hebrew script that's used by everybody in the region. But it tells you, again, these Philistines are starting to use local script as opposed to their script, right, their Cypro-Minoan script. And they found this inscription, which says, the temple which he built, Achish, son of Padi, son of Yisad, etc., etc., for his lady, right, the goddess, ruler of Ekron. He's the ruler of Ekron. And it's found in Rivadim. It's found in Tel Mikneh. So Natan Idlin's hypothesis based on his knowledge of Tanakh was indeed proven. And it's such a great Tanakh mystery story, archaeology story, that the mystery is solved through archaeology, but also through knowledge of what happened. Now, let's go to Gat, okay? a little bit to the south of the city of Ekron, the rediscovered city of Ekron, is this very large and impressive tell. It's really a massive site. And it's called Tel Asafi by the Arabs, okay? It's, which means the white tell, because it has these chalk cliffs, as you can see in the picture, right? It's kind of blindingly white. And since the late 1990s, Professor Aaron Mayer of Bar-Ilan University has been digging there. And he says he's going to dig there either till, you know, the money runs out or the site is finished, and he's just going to keep going. There's an Arab village that was near here. The graves are protected. But other than that, they really have been digging both on top of the tell and at the bottom. It's a massive, massive site. We're going to come back to it. But basically, it's the largest site in the area, and it is clearly Philistine. It's a lot of Philistine artifacts that were found here, and there's no other good contender for Gat. So like I said, we haven't found the Welcome to Gat sign, but this is the most logical choice for Gat, even though it's not officially called Tel Gat yet. Who knows what we will find in the future. Okay, we'll come back to Gat, do not worry. But let's talk a little about Philistine religion, okay? The Philistine religion, the Tanakh does not tell us so much. And this follows in line with the Tanakh's approach in general to idolatry, which is, as we would say colloquially, this is narishkeit, right? This is silliness. You don't need to know so much about it. But we actually want to know about it. We're interested. But what do we know about the Philistines' habits, rituals, whatever, beliefs? What do we know about them? Not so much. What we know is there's a very strong emphasis on the fact that they are not circumcised, right? Every time you want to insult a Philistine, they are arelim, they're uncircumcised. So for example, take a look at the first source here. Samson wants to marry a Philistine girl, right? It comes home, mom and dad, I met this girl in college. His father and mother say to him, is there no one among the daughters of your own kinsmen and among all our people that you must go and take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines, right? And again, that's always the jibe against them, okay? When King Saul wants to have David kind of put him into danger, he says to him, he basically wants him to kill Philistines, right? Hoping he'll be killed in battle. And he says, you need to bring me, he doesn't say, mea plishtim, 100 Philistines, they're dead bodies. He says, mea orlot plishtim, bring me 100 foreskins. Presumably he's got to kill them before he's getting the foreskins. But we're always emphasizing this arelut, this uncircumcised. Okay. What else do we know? We know they have a god called Dagon. We don't know anything about this god, right? The suggestion is, either that comes from the word dag, right? Fish, they're seafarers, they live by the sea. Maybe their god is some kind of a fish. Or Dagan, grain. Maybe their god is a god of grain. We don't know. Okay, so far we have not found a Dagon. We only know about it from Tanakh. And we also know that their temple, this is again back to the story of Samson, has pillars. Okay, remember he holds the middle pillars that the temple rested upon and he pushes them out, right? Tamut nafshim plishtim, I'm going to die and take the Philistines with me. So we have temples with pillars, Dagon as a god, and uncircumcised. That's what we know about Philistine religion from Tanakh. What can archaeology tell us? Okay, so here's where we get to the awkward part of this talk. It seems that this emphasis on uncircumcised, on arelim, is borne out by archaeology, right? Now, these strange little objects, and whenever you don't know what something is, you say it is occultic. But if you look at it, it bears not a slight resemblance to a phallus, right? Why would you have a cultic object that looks like that? Perhaps that is part of their religion. And we know that they have a goddess who's called Pangaea, who is a goddess who has a phallus, and their priests were castrated. Maybe when you talk about them being arelim, you're, as Aaron Mayer says, hitting them where it hurts, right? This is very important to them. It also helps us to understand a very strange part of the story with the ark, right? Where we know that God strikes them. He strikes the different towns that have the ark. One plague we understand, it's mice. The other plague, very strange. The hand of the Lord lay heavy upon the Ashdodites, and he wrought havoc upon them. He struck Ashdod and its territory with hemorrhoids. Afelim, we don't know what this means, right? And Aaron Mayer suggests that perhaps this is, again, the same idea, that it's something that is striking them in this very sensitive place, and maybe that's because it's so important to them in a religious sense. Interesting suggestion. That's all I can say about it for the moment. What about the temples? Okay, so far we have unearthed temples in Tel Kasila, right, which is on the grounds of the Eretz Yisrael Museum in Tel Aviv. There's an actual tell on the grounds of the museum. It's really cool. In Ekron and just recently in Gat, okay, and they have pillars. Okay, take a look at the pillars. Okay, it's not so unusual. Many buildings will have pillars, but to have center pillars that fits with what we hear about in Tanakh, that are holding up the structure. They also, where we have, for example, in Ekron or in Tel Kasila, layers of temples, right? Subsequent, often temples are built in the same place, century after century, but they're renovated. The earlier ones, again, much more of a Greek design, this hearth design. The later ones, much more of a Canaanite Israelite kind of a design. Okay, one more thing about their religion, two more things about their religion. We found these cultic objects, and these are actually copies, but you can also see the real ones. Most of these pictures, by the way, are from a wonderful museum in Ashdod called the Museum of Philistine Culture, where they have, it's mostly copies, but it's just beautifully, beautifully done. The real stuff is in the Israel Museum. So what do we have? From Ashdod Yam, we excavated, and that's the picture on the left, a lot of these like mini temples. Right? And some people might remember, people who came last week, they remember that we had a mini temple in Kayafa, right? In what we think is a Judahite site. So you have this mini temple. The difference here is that this is an incense burner, right? See the top? You put a fire in the inside, you put incense on the top, and it's an incense burner, the same thing with what's on the right, but that's something different. We'll come to that in a second. Okay. Maybe this is what their temple looked like. Maybe it's a model that can show us their temple. We really don't know, but it's an interesting suggestion. The one on the right is also fascinating because if you look at the little figures, I don't know how well you can see it here, but the little figures are playing instruments, okay? This guy is playing a flute. This guy is playing some other kind of a wind instrument, right? One of them's playing a harp. Did they connect music to their ritual, right? We know Tanakh talks about music that brings on prophecy. Maybe they had music, and we had music in our temples. Maybe they had music in their temples. It's very intriguing. Again, a little bit of a question mark. And finally, we have found, so far, we haven't found Dagon, but we have found a goddess, and that's the picture on the left. She has gotten the name Ashdoda. We don't know what her real name was, but she was found in Ashdod, so she's called Ashdoda, and she's a rather interesting combination of a woman, you can see her breasts, and a chair. Maybe it's a fertility figure, right? Again, we don't know, maybe connected to this idea of the goddess with the phallus, this is the counterpart. A lot of open questions. The picture on the right was discovered in Tel Asafi, in what we think is Gat, where they found some really fascinating things in the last few years. At the bottom, in the lower city, they found a temple. They actually found a Philistine temple. And in it, they found this complete altar, right? Take a look at this beautiful altar. It's about 3.5 feet high. And if you know a little bit about ritual objects in Israelite culture, right, you'll see some similarities and some differences, right? It's square, it's got right angles, so it should remind you of the incense altar in the Mikdash, right, or a smaller scale version of the large altar in the temple. It's got these right angles, it's got horns, but it's only got two horns, right? The altar in the temple in Jerusalem and in the Mishkan, it has four horns. This has two horns. They are not broken off. This was originally two-horned, okay? Why? Perhaps it's meant to look like a bull. Bulls are very important in Minoan culture. It's also got this groove, which is not something that is in our altars, okay? So it has similarities to an Israelite altar, not to Canaanite Bama, by the way, but to an Israelite altar, but it has its own unique qualities as well. So this gives us a little bit of a window into Philistine religion. We still have a lot of questions. Okay, what else can we know about them from archaeological site? Well, we always want to know about food, right? Food is very important. Food is one of the things that we call an ethnic marker, something that tells us, that might tell us, who are the people who lived in these places, because What you eat is often determined by your religion, by your culture. People who came last week may remember the picture on the right. These are beer jugs. These are Philistine beer jugs with those beautiful birds on them. And they have the strainer, right? They have this little strainer to strain out the hops. Philistine sites have lots of beer. They loved beer. Israelite sites, Canaanite sites, much less. Okay. The picture on the left, unless you are a biologist, I'm guessing you're not guessing what animal that is, but it's a pig skull. Okay. Pigs are found all over Philistine sites, and they are almost never found in Israelite sites. Canaanites are the interesting in the middle. They also don't have a lot of pig. Now, they don't have our dietary laws. Why are they not eating pigs? And some archaeologists suggest that as the Philistines become more powerful, the Canaanites say, I don't want to be associated with those guys. I'm going to start changing my diet. I'm not going to eat like them. Whether you accept that or not, when you find pigs, and certainly combined with the Philistine pottery, it tells you that this is probably not an Israelite site, but a Philistine site. Okay, we're gonna take a look, do a little bit of a tour at a couple of specific sites and not just general, okay? One of the most impressive sites in the last few decades is Ashkelon, okay? The Leon Levy expedition that's been digging there. Lawrence Steger has been digging there for a long time, and they've been discovering amazing, amazing things, both in the earlier city as well as in the Roman, Byzantine, and Crusader. We're going to focus on the earlier stuff. So Ashkelon is a major city. It's on the coast, of course, right? So making it a very important, powerful city. It's first a very powerful Canaanite city, okay? Mid-Bronze, about 4,000 years ago. And we have discovered its city walls. And one of the really extraordinary things that we've discovered is the picture you can see here on the left. And this is the remains of an arch, right? You can see the gate into the city. This obviously is reconstructed, but you can see what's left of an arch made out of mud bricks. Even more phenomenal, from the same time period up north in Tel Dan, we found a complete arch. And what that tells us is that we thought arches were invented by the Romans 2,000 years later. It's not true. The Canaanites already had arches, right, in mid-Bronze Age. So that's already just something interesting, nothing to do with the Philistines, but kind of neat to know about. The other thing that was discovered that's very significant from the Canaanite city is this little silver calf was found right on the outskirts of the city, right by the wall. It had its own little temple that it went in. Here's again a temple. This one's not particularly fancy, but it's the home of the silver calf. And that should be ringing bells in your head, right? Calf is not a good sign for B'nai Israel, right? We worship the golden calf. Yeravam, when he creates his breakaway temple, he puts calves in it. A calf is a powerful Canaanite idol, and it's found here. So it's kind of a neat thing to know about and to find. But the Philistines come, they invade, they conquer the city, they take over, and it becomes a Philistine city. And its power, remember we said different times, different cities. Ashkelon's finest hour is from the 7th century on. Up until that point, Gat is really the powerful city. Then it becomes Ashkelon. And it is it's an economic powerhouse, right? And in fact, if you look at how I wrote the word Ashkelon up here, the word shekel is in the word Ashkelon. Shekel meaning, today we think of it as a coin, but shekel is lishkol, to weigh, okay? And Ashkelon was a market city. It was a place where you had weights and measures. So you have a picture on the left here of this nice kind of a depiction of the marketplace, but on the right you have actual weights and measures that were found in the marketplace. The marketplace was excavated not so long ago. The city was completely destroyed in the year 604 BCE by Nebuchadnezzar. Are, and a lot of the remains of the marketplace are still there, and the archaeologists uncovered it, and they found weights, they found silver, they found goods from all over, okay, imported fish from Greece, as well as stuff that seems to have been ready for export, right, remains of wheat. They found pottery, beautiful imported pottery, very plain local pottery, This was a trade. This was a trade center for a trade network from all over the Mediterranean. Okay, that's Ashkelon. Tells us a lot about the power of the Philistines, their economic power. But perhaps the most jaw-dropping thing that was discovered in Ashkelon was something that relates to this question, right? How are the Philistines buried? Again, we didn't know very much. Tanakh tells us nothing. These handsome fellas, which are at the entrance to the archaeology wing of the Israel Museum today. These are sort of mummies, but not really, meaning they're arthropods. They're coffins that look like humans, okay? Only their faces in many cases are these very grotesque, weird, like with the weird little hands, okay? But they don't have mummies inside, okay? They just have skeletons inside. And this is how we thought the Philistines buried, but it turns out that only in certain places did the Philistines bury like this. And in Ashkelon, they actually found a cemetery with over 200 burials. And that's already something where you can have a lot of information. You can find out a lot of things. We're going to hear something about DNA towards the end. But first, just how did they bury? Okay, unlike the Israelites and the Canaanites and the Phoenicians and so many people in our region, they didn't do a primary and secondary burial, which is lay out the body, let it decompose, take the bones, put them somewhere else. No, the whole skeleton is found here, as you can see in this very graphic skeleton. They weren't disturbed. They were put directly into pits, sometimes with small personal items. Sometimes they were cremated, but a lot of times we found the skeletons. And one of the really neat things that they found here, take a look, right by this guy's cheek or eye, it's a little perfume jug. I guess it's a smelly journey to the next world. So you want to have that. But finding burial, right? Up until now, all our thoughts about burial were really conjecture. And right now we really have concrete evidence that at least in Ashkelon, this is how they buried. And like I said, we're going to come back to the DNA at the very end. But let's take a look for a moment at Gat, because Gat, like I said, so big, so much that's being discovered there. It is a very powerful site. It is one of the largest cities in the area, 500 dunam. I don't know how to translate that to acres. Sorry, but it's big, okay? But more important even than its size, is an upper city, there's a lower city. When you go to the top, you climb up to the top, it's a beautiful hike, you can see the whole area, right? You can see to the sea, you can see to the mountains, you can see the whole area. It commands everything. And perhaps this is the reason why Judah can't expand much further. People who came last week, we talked about Caiapha and why it kind of disappears after a very short time period, maybe because it's of the looming threat of Gat, right? That's waiting to attack. But it is a very powerful place. And among the many things that were discovered in the last, like I said, almost 20 years of excavations, right? We have a few that really stand out. Here you have this. I was tempted to use the Gustave Doré picture that everybody uses. Sorry, everybody uses it, but it's a good picture, right? David holding up Goliath's head, this nice bloody picture. If you have some 10-year-olds at home, they'll love this picture. But they found a piece of pottery, and that's the picture on the right, that says in Semitic script, okay, not in the script that they brought from Greece, it says Aliatus, Waliatus Aliatus, okay? This is not a Semitic name. This is an Indo-European name. Not only that, it sounds a lot like Goliath, okay? Is this Goliath's, you know, coffee cup? No. But it does tell us that the story is using names that were Philistine names. And it tells us, again, here we have this Indo-European name written in Semitic characters. We're in this border between cultures, okay? What else was found in Gat? Hey, this was just recently in the last couple of years, the last couple of seasons of excavation. They started to excavate in the lower city and they found some really amazing things. Number one, they found a metal workshop. We're going to talk about Philistines and metal in a second. Metal workshop, very similar to the techniques that are used in Cyprus, not the Canaanite metalworking techniques. Again, they're taking their culture from other places. They found a temple. That's where the altar that I showed you is from. And they found gates to the city. Now, this is exciting if you know your Tanakh, because if you remember, David is on the run from King Saul. King Saul wants to kill him, and he runs and he runs and he runs to the place, the one place that King Saul is never going to go, and that's into the arms of the Philistines. He runs to the city of Gat, to the king, to Achish, and Achish is about to welcome him in with open arms. Here's this, you know, real hero of the Israelites, and he's coming to me. But then people start saying to him, well, you know, this is the guy that defeated our hero, our champion, Goliath. Maybe he's not so safe after all. And David recognizes that this is not a good sign. He's got to get himself out of this jam. So he pretends to be crazy, right? So he concealed his good sense. He feigned madness for their benefit. And Rashi tells us that the daughter of Achish was mad, and this kind of hit him in a sensitive place. And what does he do? He scratched marks on the doors of the gate. So is David, are we going to find the marks on the gates of Gat? I don't know, but we do find the marks of the city of Gat, and that's a fascinating thing. Okay, one last bit about metal production. Okay, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to leave a lot of time for questions. We have this very famous verse in the book of Samuel that the Philistines control metal production, that even when the Israelites need their farming implements sharpened, they have to go to Plishti land, right? And it tells us how much it costs, by the way. And we found a weight that says that name, the Pim. Okay? But no smith was to be found in the land of Israel, for the Philistines were afraid the Hebrews would make swords or spears. So they would go to the Philistines. Now, the fascinating thing is, yes, here we found a metal workshop in Gat, but we also found a metal workshop in Israelite Beit Shemesh. So is this happening after the Tanakh story? Is it only in certain places where the Israelites didn't have the tools of metal production? Interesting question again. Okay, we're going to spend a minute on this fascinating site in the north. One of these groups is called the Shardona. About 15 years ago, a very interesting archaeologist named Adam Zartal uncovered a site not so far from the new city of Katsir, right? It's Wadi Ara, like if you go up Route 6, before you get to the area of Haifa, you are right in this little town called Katsir. And right outside of it is an archaeological site that's very strange. And that's, look at the drawing for a minute, right? It's got these weird wavy walls. It's got these strange towers. It's got these tunnels in the wall. It doesn't look like anything Israelite. It doesn't look like anything Canaanite. Based on the pottery and other things that were found there, it's from the 13th century, the 12th century. Who are these guys, right? Whose town is this? It's called El Ahwat by the Arabs, but who actually lived here? And Zartal was very puzzled because he couldn't find anything that looked like it. And he brought all sorts of people to look at it. And someone said to him, you know, this looks a lot like places I've seen in Sardinia, right? Sardinia, Italy. And Zartal actually picks himself up, goes to Sardinia, to archaeological sites there, and he sees that indeed it does look like places in Sardinia. And he thinks that there is a group of, we know there's a group of these sea peoples called the Shardona, Sardinia, right? And he suggests two things. Number one, that Sisra, in the story of Devorah and Barak, Sisra comes from the Shardona, and he's a mercenary who works for the Canaanite king Yavin, and that this is his city, Haroshet Goyim. Is this the case? It's very interesting, right? And one of the things we know about Haroshet Goyim is that Sisra has a heck of a lot of chariots. That's his power, is the chariots. What did Zartal find in El Ahwat? He found this very beautiful, take a look at the picture on the left, this very beautiful decorated chariot linchpin, right? See in the drawing, goes right over here, okay? This linchpin is for a fancy chariot. Were these Sisra's chariots? Did he use them in his failed battle against Barak? Was El Ahwat the Shardona city of Haroshet Goyim? Again, a lot of question marks, but very intriguing. But let's finish up, because here's where we get to the clincher of our story, okay? And this is what I alluded to in the beginning. The Philistines are master assimilators, and this is why they are so successful, right? They learn how to fit in. New immigrants need to learn how to fit in, okay? Their language goes from a Greek-like language to Semitic writing, okay? Their pottery changes, and this is what you can see here, from this very beautiful, ornate, birds and decorations to a much plainer Canaanite style. And in fact, some of them even have drawings of date palms on them, which is like the classic decoration of the land of Israel. Their temples change. And here's the strangest one. Now that we have these cemeteries, we can analyze DNA, this cemetery, one cemetery, right? And the DNA of the earlier burials, right? The early Iron Age, the earliest burials in this cemetery, most of them were infants, very tragic, under a house. And their DNA shows European ancestry, okay? Probably Greek. The burials that are later, okay? And there's a whole scientific paper on this if you want to read it, are the DNA of Europeans mixed in with local Canaanite DNA. So in the words of the late Professor Trudy Dotan, who studied the Philistines extensively, they assimilate so well that they assimilate themselves ultimately out of existence. Right? They become so like the local peoples that when they are conquered, right? Remember we said we have a shared destiny, but when they are conquered by the Babylonians, they never reestablish themselves again as a unique nation. And we'll let the last word be King David, because he really is saying this very idea, right? In his battle against Goliath, yes, he's a warrior. Yes, he's a master fighter. But what's important is his speech. Goliath is goading him. What am I, a dog, that you come at me with sticks? And David replied, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the ranks of Israel, whom you have defied. This very day, the Lord will deliver you into my hands. And just skip to the bottom. And this whole assembly shall know the Lord can give victory without sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will deliver you into our hands. Ultimately, the power of the Israelites is what King David is expressing. This belief in God, this belief in a national destiny. And that's why a small group of Jews will return from Babylonia and reestablish themselves here as a nation. And also the ones of Babylonia will retain their unique identity, whereas the Philistines, who are so powerful, never get their identity back again. So assimilating should only go so far. All right, so let's take a look at 33 questions. Oh my gosh. All right, let's see. Going back to the beginning here. Okay, good morning, good morning. Crete or Plate? Yeah, so that's also, again, you're right, Crete. Crete or Plate, as they're coming from the land of Crete. Okay, thank you. That's Ellen. Cretans and Philistines. That is very interesting. I do not know. I do not know. You'd have to look up, you know, the origins of Cretan. But yeah, Crete, maybe that's where it comes from. I did not know that. Thank you, Rivka Esther. Homework. Find out for next week if that's really where it's from. Okay. Foreign countries number 5, like the 5 cities of the Plishtim, maybe. And the writing on the relief is hieroglyphic. Yes, because it's Egyptian. Volume, I can't answer your volume question. Did the Plishtim come to the coast directly or from Egypt? From what it seems like, at least from Ramses's temple, they try their luck in Egypt and it doesn't work, right? And they make their way up the coast to us, okay? And again, the Kreti and Pleiti before they're adopted by Rabbi Ibeshitz. Thank you. That's very nice. In the Exodus, the route not taken is called Derech Eretz Plishtim. Again, the rabbis use the term Dibra Torah Al Shem Sofa, right? We're talking about, you might say something because that's how people in later generations will know it. Eretz Plishtim was well known as the land of the Philistines later on. So it might be that that's the language that's used, or it might be referring to these earlier Philistines. Okay? And again, Derech Eretz Plishtim, going up the coast. The area is known as the Philistine lands, even if the Philistines are not there yet. Okay, Philistines are not indigenous to land, correct. Ibn Ezra implies Ad Hayom Hazeh were words added after Moses and not by Joshua when recalling place names. Are we talking about Derech Eretz Plishtim? I do not know. Okay, you are sophisticated. I know, I said you're sophisticated. You are very sophisticated. Okay, Isn't Goliath descended from Orpah, Ruth's sister-in-law, who returns to her native Moab rather than continuing to Israel? She comes from the east and is identified as a Moabite woman. How did Goliath eventually turn out to be Philistine? Intermarriage. Okay, yes, I would say it is a drash, as Mr. Barinholtz writes here, but it's not only it, meaning in Divrei Hayamim, if I'm remembering correctly, it does talk about Goliath's connection to other giants, and I think to Orpah. I would have to check back on it, but certainly they could be intermarriage, like we said. I don't know if Rabbi Kalman wants to weigh in on that one. Can't uncircumcised also be another way of saying not one of us? Yes, it definitely can. But and that's how it always was understood, meaning we don't like you, you're not like us, you don't do these things that we do. That is totally true. But there might be a deeper level to it. The phallic, like cultic item, looked circumcised. I'm not even going in that direction, but it might be that that's what they use for the for their religion. But there definitely is an emphasis on the phallus. Did Greeks anytime eat pigs? I assume Greeks did eat pigs. They have no reason not to. I don't know what Jabba the Hutt is or Buddha. Oh, those are those guys, the anthropods. Yes. Looks like his femurs are bent. Did he have rickets? Again, you have to read the archaeological report. I don't know if anybody found out if he had rickets. Ellie Paso, is this the acres and the dunam? Thank you. Okay, 500 dunam, 500,000 square meters. Very big. The crying baby might have been from my side, so I apologize. It's not my baby, but I think outside my neighbor. Okay, dunams, acres, Greek script, not a specific Greek script, but we do have, and I have to look back and remember, right? It's Cypro-Minoan, if you know. If you know Greek scripts, which I do not, right? But their earlier inscriptions are in this script that is not a Semitic, right? Not an early Hebrew script. 13th century BCE, yes, BCE. Any more questions? Thank you for all the compliments. Right, again, Derech Eretz Plishtim, we've mentioned. Again, Dibra Torah al Shem Sofa, that's the only answer I can give to you. I can do more research if you don't like that one. Did they measure the skeleton, Audrey asked, meaning how tall it is? Yes, I'm sure they did, but I do not have that information at my fingertips. Cretin is derived from the Swiss-French Alpine dialect crestin, from the Latin word Christianum. We like the other answer better, Mr. Barinholtz. I'm sorry. There was another battle with another giant named Goliath near the end of Samuel. Right. There's this, I don't remember if it's Goliath or it's his brother, right? We have to look it up. Okay, other questions, other comments? I don't know if Rabbi Kalman wants to weigh in on anything.
No, I listen to you, the expert. And the Ad HaYom HaZeh, the Derech Eretz Plishtim, that we can talk about another time. Of course, it's from this week's Parsha. You can look at the Ibn Ezra on that, his famous comment, and the idea of Wefford's reference, what will be later, and if that later is after the time the Torah was given, that's beyond the scope of what we can do now. That has to be a separate thing. But thank you very much, and I'll second all the comments. This evening, Joel Finkelstein, Rabbi Joel Finkelstein from Memphis, Tennessee, our Parsha Shir, Sunday morning, Rabbi Liebtag, followed by Rabbi Mundi Ivrit on the technology, the Shabbos of the future, then our regular